Thank you, Justices, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. I just want to start out briefly, really about the heart of this. I think there's a lot of agreement in terms of, I think both sides here agree that the plain meaning of the statute controls. I couldn't agree more. But what we can't lose sight of, and what the appellate division cited and relied upon, what this court has relied upon on WS, is the remedial nature and the sweeping massive reforms, unprecedented in the CVA and the amendments to the CSAA, which is before the court today. The plague on society of having a child sexually abused, raped, one of our biggest duties to protect. This court has recognized that. Certainly the legislature has recognized that. What we're talking about here is preventing child sexual abuse, not only against the abuser, many times, even more importantly, against the institutions or entities that allow it. And when we're talking today, what I think my adversary has lost sight of, respectfully, is they've stated this is a new standard of liability. This is going to open up the floodgates. Statutorily, a cause of action for passive liability is almost a criminal standard. Knowingly, parentheses, willfully, permitting or acquiescing in child sexual abuse. And when these sweeping reforms were enacted, Governor Murphy initially said, I'm going to sign this conditionally with the assurances from the legislature that they're going to fix what he perceived, and what was correct, of inequities between private and public entities. Equipos. The legislators, when this bill was signed, the hallmark of it was focused on the institutions that allow this to happen. If our institutions can't keep their members safe and hold their employees accountable, then we will. With this bill, we're making it clear New Jersey stands with survivors first. Another statement, we have an obligation to hold organizations and institutions accountable for the bad actions of their employees. And I would submit respectfully to this court, there's no worse actions. And what I'd like to do is, because there's been a lot of talk today about the plain meaning of the statute, and I couldn't agree more. And I would submit to the court that a plain reading, and I'm referring to the sweeping new statutes, 2A 14, or 2A colon 14-2A, which is the extension of the statute of limitations, and then 14B, which is that look back period, that 2-year period. It's clear as day, justices. Section A provides every action at law for an injury resulting from the commission of sexual assault, any other crime of sexual nature, a prohibited sexual act as defined in a section not before the court today, or sexual abuse as defined in Section 1 of Public Law 1992, the Child Sexual Abuse Act, 2A, 61B, dash 1, against a minor under the age of 18, that occurred prior to, on, or after the effective date of the reforms shall be commenced than 37 years after the age of majority, commonly known as before your 55th birthday. Subsection B does the same. Now, it's explicit in that statute that an action pursuant to the CSAA, it's right in the statute, is subject to occur before, on, or after, is subject to this enhanced statute of limitations. The argument that they utilized, and this didn't come up, Mel, the municipal excess liability amicus brought this up. They said, well, I know what happened here. When they used the definition in the statute, they didn't put as amended. That's the entirety of their statutory construction argument. In other words, what they're saying is, because the legislature, when they specifically included a CSAA statutory cause of action, they didn't put the law as amended.
Respectfully, counsel, I don't think that's their argument. And I don't think their argument is a general argument that the floodgates would open. The floodgate aspect of it was really in response to questions about the fiscal impact. I think what their argument is that the amendment uses prospective language, and the legislative history specifically refers to prospective at the end of that section of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so I don't think it's respectfully fair to say that they have this, all they're saying is that as amended should have been used. I didn't hear that at all today. I know it's in briefs, but I didn't hear that at all today. I don't think that's the heart of their argument.
But, and respectfully, Justice Patterson, the plain language, there's certainly nothing in the plain language that would support that argument.
But why is that? So the plain language, I thought they're arguing that for the change of the statute of limitations, and you just went through it, it all applies to any act that occurred prior to, on, or after the effective date. And that's for the statute of limitations change. However, that's not what this litigation is about. This litigation is about the deletion of the words within the household from the definition of sexual abuse under the CSAA, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and that's section 4 specifically of chapter 120, correct?
Respectfully, Your Honor, Justice, that's in the legislative history. We don't even get by what I'm saying, what I'm trying to tell
you. No, sorry. I'm just talking about the words within that household. They used to be there, and now they're not. And what deleted them was section 4 of chapter 120, correct?
Yes, Justice, yes.
Okay, so that's the only thing I'm talking about. And then for that, it specifically says the provisions of this amendatory and supplementary act, Public Law 2019, Chapter 120, shall take effect on December 1st, 2019. That's correct.
That is accurate, Justice.
Okay, so then I thought their argument was that for the statute of limitations, it is expressed that it applies prior to acts that occurred prior to. However, for the deletion of the words within the household from the definition of sexual abuse in the CSAA, it says that it applies only prospectively because it takes effect only on December 1st, 2019.
I believe that's a component of their argument. I think more of their argument relies upon the legislative history outlined, in, I think, in the Appendix DA 77. What I'm saying initially, or what I'm trying to get across, and maybe I'm not coming across as clear as I'd like to be, is the express language of the statute. There's zero ambiguity.
But where is that? Sorry. I see the express language about the statute of limitations applying retroactively. Where is the express language about the deletions of the words within the household applying retroactively? That's what I'm having trouble seeing.
Okay. So what I just read to you was the component about what does the massive expansion of statute of limitations apply to. Specified exactly in there is the Child Sexual Abuse Act.
That's the definition of sexual conduct. What the legislature did, as I read that language, is to rather than go through a long definition of what constitutes sexual conduct, obviously a very critical part of this, they referred to the types of conduct that in the amendment to in section 13.1.3 for the Tort Claims Act immunities, and then they pulled out a definition of sexual conduct from the CSAA, But what is retroactive clearly in that is the conduct goes backwards for all of those categories back to conduct that preceded this act and the reopening of the statute of limitations. The reference to the CSAA, as I read that, is referring to sexual conduct that is within the CSAA and as defined there.
And I agree, Justice. That's where you.
That's not the within the household aspect of it, because that's the that is not pulling out the language respectfully that I think you're saying it does. It doesn't say anything about that elimination of within the household. They're simply cross-referencing, as they often do, and it's helpful and it saves words, definitions of sexual abuse and misconduct that were existed in components of the statutes that they were amending.
And that's certainly a fair interpretation, Justice. My argument was that as you're defining sexual abuse by referring to that statute, it encompasses passive abuse. But we don't even have to get there, because the plain language again says every action at law. So every action at law of sexual nature, obviously it's encompassed, right?
And it's saying clear as day that it's reopening the statute of limitations for previously expired claims for 2 years. And that's what that section seems to be doing.
Yes. But there's no, in other words, if the legislature wanted to, the way this reads, respectfully, in my opinion, is that if you have a statutory cause of action, common law cause of action, every action at law, this is the statute of limitations that applies. And they specifically put the language in there that occurred prior to, on, or after.
So you're saying the entire Child Victims Act and all the amendments to three statutes were all retroactive, even though certain of them say this one's retroactive. And this one has the language that we typically associate with prospective application, which is the effective date language.
Well, the prospective language comes other than, you know, this action, this shall take effect mm-hmm. on X date, only comes from the legislative history of Section 4.
But this shall take effect on this date when that date is in the future is generally prospective, correct? So if there was nothing that said prior to, and the only thing we had was here's a new law and it's going to go into effect in 11 months, presumably then that's prospective application, correct?
Generally, I would agree with you, Justice, not in the context of the Child Sexual Abuse Act. So when you go back to 1992, was the first time that there was a statutory cause of action for child sexual abuse against an active or passive abuser. And at that time, admittedly, it had the requirement within the household. When that was enacted, it was the same language, Justice, that this bill had about an effective date. And there was, and I cited this in my briefing, there's a case expressly on point, but also when you look at this case, Hardwick wasn't even raised. You know, Hardwick, the abuse happened in the 60s or early 70s. Hardwick's complaint was filed in 2001.
I thought that your adversary said that even though the abuse happened in 2001, the cause of action did not accrue until much later because of case law about when the cause of action accrued. And so in Hardwick, the cause of action did not accrue until after the 1992 Act had gone into effect.
I don't know if that's the case, Judge. I mean, Your Honor, Justice, I'm sorry, I'm used to battling
problem,
the trial court.
Mm-hmm.
But let's clarify that, okay? So in 1999, in JL, which I had cited, versus JF, reported in the Appellate Division, 1999. That was also a case about, you know, there was always litigation about the discovery rule and Lopez hearings and what have you. The Appellate Division explicitly stated, right, and you assume that the legislature knows this and knows about the verbiage utilized in when they initially enacted the Child Sexual Abuse Act. In any event, At 429 in JL, in 1992, the legislature established a statutory civil cause of action for sexual abuse in NJSA 2A:61(b)(1). The act is prospective and shall not apply to any action which is commenced before the effective date. Quote, a civil action is commenced by filing a complaint with the court, and it cites rule 4:2-2. And then the court held, because the complaint in this matter was filed in 1995, the 2A:61(b) or the Child Sexual Abuse Act applies. So in the context of the Child Sexual Abuse Act, that's how it has been historically interpreted. And I actually liked, and I don't know who put it together, but in this case, when it was posted what the issue is, it was, it didn't go between prospective and retroactivity, clearly stated, do these amendments apply to abuse that happened before? And I like that because we get into this prospective retroactive argument, which I submit, certainly rules of statutory construction apply without question. And we can get into the legislative history, which I had outlined, even though I submit we don't get there. But in the context of this type of remedial statute, and going to the plain meaning, the legislative history, but basic common sense, this is the worst of the worst, right? An institution or entity that knowingly permits this abuse, we're going to allow, and by the way, we can't forget where this case started. When I was before the appellate division, and they had dropped those claims, my adversaries were challenging the common law claims. I actually stood before the appellate division with a law against discrimination claim. That was the only claim not challenged. They've dropped that in this case.
Meaning they dropped the challenge to it.
Well, the appellate division below ruled, they initially, their position was you needed a tort claims notice for the ancillary or related common law causes of action.
But then after WS, the common law claims are still in the case, correct?
No. WS dealt with the, and it's interesting procedurally, Justice, WS dealt with tort claims notice for a CSAA claim. There was a footnote in WS by this court that says, if the attorney general would like to go back, and it's not really before us, but if you'd like to go back and talk about whether or not it's required for common law claims, do that in the trial court. Attorney general did not do that. Another attorney representing the defendants in WS did. That was denied by the trial court there. Leave to appeal was also denied. I had the exact same issues, actually the exact same attorney, and leave to appeal was granted. You know, lucky me in my case.
Let me ask you something. Are you saying that there's no issue here of prospective versus retroactive?
In terms of a statutory claim?
But the CSAA claim, the claim you're here before. You're saying you really don't like the terminology prospective or retroactive?
No, I didn't mean it that way, Justice. I meant that because of the nature of the subject matter, the massive reforms, and the intent behind this law, you know, like a strict application of Maya doesn't work, right? So this court in WS, now in WS, it was whether or not a tort claims notice is required for a statutory cause of action. Well, if it was, then the statutory cause of action, whether within the household, not within the household, you're out of luck.
I understood Maya and WS to be making a distinction between substantive changes and procedural changes. And so for a procedural change about how a complaint has to be filed, for example, if there was a change to how many pages your brief would be, that is determined by the date the complaint was filed, or in the case of how long your brief is going to be, the date that your brief is due and when the procedural change goes into effect. But Maya is saying that for substantive changes that are actually changing who is liable and how, then a prospective effect would be only to apply it to actions undertaken after the date that the change is made. So here, in the definition of sexual abuse in the CSAA,
deleting the words within the household, so that one standing in loco parentis who knowingly permits sexual abuse will now be liable regardless of whether they were in the household. Would you call that substantive or procedural?
In the context of WS, I would consider it procedural in removing a barrier.
How could that possibly be procedural? It's the actual definition of what constitutes sexual abuse, and it's removing a part of it such that something that didn't used to be sexual abuse now is. So it used to be that if there was sexual abuse, but it did not occur with someone who was in loco parentis within the household, then no liability. But now we're deleting the words within the household. And so now if it occurs with someone in loco parentis who is not within the household, yes, liability.
Correct. But if I could draw your attention, Justice, to actually the legislative history that is at issue here. In DA, outlining section 4, DA 77, the legislature went through, when you started section 4, in the first paragraph, and there has to be a reason. There has to be a reason they did this. And in the first paragraph, they cite the standard for a passive abuser. Now, again, we're now into the legislative history, but they don't use...
Well, let's put that in context.
Yes.
Because what they weren't just saying, we're going to define passive abuser. They're saying the section amends the CSAA to apply the new extended statute of limitations period for child victims of abuse detailed in section 2, et cetera. I'm skipping over some language. In lawsuits filed against two specific categories of abusers, the active abuser and the passive abuser, both defined. So what this is saying is we are explaining the portion of section 4 that creates this very, very favorable and new statute of limitations that's going to reopen cases that were previously barred. And it was saying, what are those two cases? Who are they against? Two categories of abusers, the active abuser and the passive abuser. It doesn't say anything there about redefining the passive abuser. That's later. And since you brought up this legislative history, it ends with is intended to only apply prospectively. Now I get that we don't reach that if the statutory language is clear, but what's your answer to that?
And I appreciate your reading of it, Justice. And what I was saying is what you just read does not include within the household when they outline that. It's clear as day, right? They omitted that from that section of the legislative history.
But they're referencing the expanded liability against a passive abuser.
Yes.
That's exactly what is being referenced in Justice Patterson's question.
Yes, Justice.
And it's only expanded because the word within the household was deleted, correct?
The extension of liability?
The way that liability was expanded, regardless of the statute of limitations, the way that the substantive liability was changed was by deleting the words within the household, correct?
Yes, but I don't know that I would consider that as a massive substantive change. And
regardless of whether it's massive, it has to be substantive because it is a definition of liability. How could changing a definition of liability ever be procedural? Whereas in the TCA amendment, for example, it very clearly says the procedural requirements of this chapter shall not apply to an action at law for an injury resulting from the commission of sexual assault, dot, dot, dot. And so our decision in WS was specifically about the procedural requirements of this chapter. And so those being prospective apply to complaints filed after the procedural requirements no longer apply. Here, you're deleting a piece of the definition of what constitutes sexual abuse. The legislature doesn't say it's procedural. How could one ever characterize the actual substance of what you can sue on to somehow be procedural?
Well, what I'm saying is, and I believe it's supported even by this legislative history, it doesn't change the standard, and that's highlighted. In WS, And I know it was categorized as procedural, but when you're...
Not categorized. The legislature specifically wrote the procedural requirements of this chapter shall not apply. So you don't have to characterize it as anything. The legislature wrote it is a procedural requirement that we are changing.
Fair enough. In WS, that procedural requirement as categorized opens up all public entities to a CSAA claim.
Counsel, why don't you assume for purposes of the next few minutes that it is a substantive change?
Okay.
The WTH amendment. What does that do to your position?
Thank you, Chief Justice. Along those lines, continuing then with the legislative history, because I have to face it, right? I acknowledge that that's in there, perspective.
But what is in there?
Perspective. The question. In the legislative history, the question is, what does that mean?
Word. It is intended to only apply prospectively. It's not just the word perspective.
Right. And I wasn't trying to minimize it. I'm not trying to hide from it. Again, I would go back to the way the CSA was always interpreted and the JL case or JY case that I had cited. But that last paragraph, before you get to that, both an active and passive abuser are subject to a knowing parentheses, willful standard of liability. And therefore, this section does not create any liability based on merely negligent acts resulting in abuse.
That doesn't change anything because all that's saying is that pure negligence is not intended to be the subject of a CSAA claim, right?
But that's the way it always was, Justice.
Sure, but it is broadening the definition of the category of people and entities that can be liable as passive abusers.
Agreed, Justice, but also differentiating between the other areas where they explicitly put retroactivity in the legislative history.
It's specific. It specifically says intended to only apply prospectively. Doesn't mean that the WTH is not retroactive. What could that possibly mean?
I'm sorry, Justice. That doesn't
could mean... the phrase intended to only apply prospectively possibly mean with regard to the WTH?
That it was intended to apply the way the CSA was always applied. The original CSA was prospective. And that was interpreted, as I had indicated, that the law in effect that a complaint was timely filed.
When you were saying the CSA originally applied prospectively, that meant that some conduct that happened before the CSAA was passed was not governed by that, right?
No, Your Honor. That's not what I'm saying at all. I think Hardwick and specifically JY addressed that directly. So my argument is these are sweeping massive reforms, right? We had it, they're still going, by the way. And when you're sitting down, look, okay, we're going to make this law. My argument is when they talk about, reiterate that this is a willful standard, not a mere negligence standard, the other sections that they refer to are opening completely new cause. Forget about parties, completely new causes of action on a negligence standard that never existed. negligent hiring, negligent supervision, gross negligence, the evisceration of the Charitable Immunity Act. And that's why I believe that they made that distinction. The CSAA was always interpreted prospectively. And in that context of the CAA, prospectively meant, in accordance with Hardwick and JY, that the law in effect at the time the complaint was filed.
Can you assume, for the sake of my question, this fact? WTH amendment creates a new tort claim where one was not previously available. Assume that for my question. Under Maya, does that mean the WTH amendment that created a new tort claim where one was not previously available applies only prospectively?
I believe if Maya was not so shockingly remedial in nature, yes. But we're talking about massive remedial legislation.
But I just wanted you to assume the fact that I included in my question. Assume for the sake of my question that it creates a new tort claim where one did not exist before. With that as being true, just for the sake of my question, does that mean it applies prospectively?
For the sake of your question, yes.
Okay.
Can you take a look at DA 73, the first page of the Senate Judiciary Committee statement, the first couple of paragraphs during discussion with your adversary? She noted the sentence that states the bill would also expand the categories of potential defendants in civil actions, and for some actions permit retroactive applications of standards of liability to past abuse for which liability did not previously exist. So what do you make of that sentence when your argument thus far has been everything in these 2019 amendments were meant to be retroactive, full stop, which is what I'm understanding your argument to be? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. So what do you make of that sentence that clearly states that only some, that these amendments are expanding categories and permit some retroactive application?
Because I truly believe that that legislative history, they did not believe they were expanding the standard for liability of a statutory cause of action. And that is referring to the creation of causes of actions based in negligence, which never existed.
Sorry, I don't understand. I'm sorry. Can you repeat that again? Because I'm not sure I understand. What is it that the legislature was referring to when they specifically said that there's only some actions that permit retroactive application of standards of liability?
You're referring to the newly created, what they're referring to as newly created.
But if it's, okay.
And what
Let
I'm
me
saying
ask you this. Are you saying, for example, under charitable immunity, that negligence, that first of all, negligence supervision is not a new cause of action created in 2019, is it?
It is not, but okay, it was so immunized.
It was immunized. That's exactly the point I was about to make.
Right.
These are not newly created causes of action. They are causes of action that in some instances, some of the very complex statute, some aspects of this statute takes immunities away from defendants that previously had them. So they're not new causes of action. They're causes of action that may have been previously immunized, but aren't any.
So which actions are you claiming are newly created?
I was referring to what Justice Patterson was referring to.
So your argument those are newly created causes of action?
That's what I believe the legislative history points to. The causes of action, expanding the liability or creating new causes of action to where there was never a cause of action before, either under the Charitable Immunity Act or the removal of the tort claims notice requirements for negligent hiring, negligent supervision. That's why I highlighted that section of the legislative history where it indicates this section does not create any liability based on merely negligent acts arising out of abuse. That's what I was trying to make the distinction between this and the removal of the charitable immunities or the tort claims immunities to allow negligence to proceed. But if I can kind of move on, unless there's any other questions.
Please do. I wanted to caution you but tell you that we're beyond a half hour. So
I need you to... So there was what I really wanted to get to is the intention behind this law, these sweeping reforms, and the absurdity and the inequities that would result if it is applied not as the appellate division applied it, but as the appellant suggests. You're taking, as I had indicated, probably the worst and hardest to prove, by the way. These cases are not easy. You're taking a very, very high standard of the worst of the worst. And you're basically telling the child sexual abuse victims, you can have common law causes of action, but the heart of the CSAA, the statutory cause of action, the remedial component of it, the one that provides damages for counseling, civil penalties, punitive damage, the one that's really going to fix or punish those who let this happen, you're out of luck.
That's the legislature makes a determination. The legislature did many, many aspects of this were expanded. But the legislature made a determination that the new statute of limitations would last 2 years and no more. It made lots of different determinations that provided some limitations on what it was doing. And I completely agree with you that it's a very, very it's a very dramatic expansion of liability, particularly in the retroactive statute of limitations. But the fact is that it can draw lines. That's a legislature's job.
Of course.
And so how could we possibly look at statutory language and legislative history and say, well, we're not going to apply their comment with respect to prospectivity, because that would be absurd somehow, because it would put a limitation on this.
Totally agree with you, Justice. They absolutely can put limitations. I would respectfully submit we don't get to the legislative history. If we do, there's the way that the CSA was always interpreted. But in terms of absurdity, that's not all. If you could think of, it's not filed yet. I have a victim horrifically sexually abused right before the enactment in December of 2001 and right after. Does she get to recover for only what happened after as a statutory cause of action? Or what about a situation, and I think this is important because it could potentially create a terrible disparity. What if maybe a more affluent family was able to send their child to a private boarding school and unfortunately, was subject to horrific child sexual abuse? They have a cause of action because that's within the household. Maybe a family that didn't have the means, their child was horrifically abused in public school. No statutory cause of action. It's just not consistent.
Counsel, respectively, isn't this conversation better done a half a mile or so away in front of a legislative hearing? I mean, you're asking us to rewrite statutes because you think that those statutes don't accurately and adequately reflect a very laudable policy. But this is not the place for that.
Point very well taken, Justice. I still respectfully submit that it's clear, even in the plain language, that an action filed within timely filed, also encompasses a statutory cause of action under the CSAA.
And that's the heart of your argument.
That's the absolute heart of the argument.
Is there anything else you'd like to focus on?
Just the legislative intent that this court had encompassed in WS and also the appellate division below. And when the appellate division below decided this, they decided in accordance with WS. And I believe that is in harmony, even despite that perspective language, with the way that the CSA was always interpreted going back to 1992, explicitly saying it was prospective, but applying to acts that happened before its enactment. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you. Mr. Kahn.
May it please the court, and if it pleases the court, I'd like to make just one brief general statement and then touch on two or three of the questions and comments and arguments that have been made so far. My general statement, when we argued WS a couple of years ago before this court, one of the defendant's arguments and one of the arguments that was made at oral argument was how unfair is this if we eliminate the requirement for tort claim notice. How unfair is this to public entities and public schools? And I was, when I argued again on as amicus counsel, I think it was Justice Patterson asked me the question, well, what about that? My answer was, let's flip that question around. How unfair is it to the victims of sexual abuse to carve out a subset of those victims, which is exactly what we're trying to do here? We're going to carve out a subset of victims to not get the benefit of the broad remedial relief.
Mr. Kahn, that's not their argument. Respectfully, your memory is better than mine as to what was said during the WS argument.
I've had less argument than you since then, Justice, but I understand.
but that may have been the argument of the defendants there. I don't remember. But the point is that they are not coming in here and saying, this is so unfair, they've made the law worse for us. That's not their argument. Their argument is they've told us what they're doing here. That's their determination. And we don't believe that it applies retroactively because of the reasons that you heard. So I agree with you that general comments that the legislature's been unfair are arguments, as Justice Hoffman said, that ought to be made to the legislature.
Yeah, well, I'm going to come back to both of those points, including their perspective and including the question that Justice Hoffman asked. But the latter part of my statement was the point I was trying to make, which is that, again, if we accept the defendant's position in this case, we are carving out a subset of victims, in this case, victims of public school or public entity abuse from,
our job is to just interpret the statute. That's all our job is.
Okay, then let me touch on some of the, if I may, because I know my time is limited, on some of the questions and arguments that have been made so far. On the financial impact, fiscal impact, I think Mr. Hubert's going to touch on this more broadly than I am. But my only comment listening to the arguments is this. If one of the fiscal impacts that may negatively affect defendants is the fact that the CSAA allows for attorney's fees, punitive damages, and if that's a new potential source of recovery, and that may have a fiscal impact, many of us plaintiffs' lawyers who file these claims, sexual abuse claims, childhood sexual abuse claims, school bullying claims, we include LED claims already, which allow for punitive damages and attorney's fees against public entities. So if that is a fiscal impact that this court is concerned about, they're in a lot of these cases anyway. I want to point that out because I don't think that's been pointed out before, number one.
But why could one of the fiscal impacts not be that all of these common law claims that were barred by the statute of limitations are being reopened and therefore can be brought against school districts for this period of 2 years?
But the legislature allowed that. We know that. We knew that was part of the whole argument when they amended the statute to allow the two-year look back or the
two-year. You're saying it could be.
I'm sorry? It was obviously anticipated in that sense. I thought there was a comment by one of the justices about how the attorney's fees and the punitive damages is something new. No. And I'm pointing out that it's really not.
I think that the inquiry so far as to fiscal impact has been, when they said there's going to be a fiscal impact on this, does that mean that of all the different things being done in the statute, this particular one should be viewed as retroactive? Otherwise, there wouldn't be the fiscal impact. I don't think anybody's commenting on whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. That's not our job.
I think the fiscal impact was obviously, I mean, it was contemplated, it was well known. And let's be honest, they all have insurance anyway, so I'm not sure.
But that's not, just to understand, at least from when I've asked about it, it's not a question of whether it's good or bad or indifferent. It's when the legislature said, yes, there's going to be a fiscal impact. Is it about this or is it about the many, many other aspects of this statute that would clearly have a significant fiscal impact?
Right, and what I'm trying to point out is that this in particular, I don't think has any, nothing we can calculate or any significantly increased fiscal impact. The fiscal impact is the fact that these claims are opened up and filed, thousands of them.
I think that cuts against plaintiff's argument because I think their argument was, well, they said it's going to be a big fiscal impact, so they must have intended this particular provision to apply retroactively.
Well, let me move on. Let me talk about that because I'm going to mention that because I think a lot of this retroactive prospective argument depends upon how we're defining prospective. And that may seem silly, but if we look at what the appellate division did in this case, citing WS, which was before this court, prospective application includes application to claims filed after the statute's effective date, regardless of when the underlying conduct occurred.
WS, we were specifically talking about procedural requirements for filing a claim. And so if the statute changes what has to be included in a complaint, then prospectively applying that means applying it to complaints filed after the statute goes into effect. This change is not procedural. It is substantive. It is the definition of sexual abuse under the CSAA, and it is removing three words from the definition such that the definition of sexual abuse becomes broader.
I understand from prior argument that I am not going to change. I don't want to say that's your opinion. That's your question. I'm not going to change. If that's your opinion, I'm not going to change that. My argument is that the statutes that were amended eliminated several obstacles to victims of prior sexual abuse filing complaints, the statute of limitations, some of the charitable immunity, the tort claim elimination of notice of claim and some of those immunities, and within the household, various obstacles were removed.
And charitable immunity.
And charitable immunity.
And there's
so I'm not
there,
sure.
There are more. There are a lot of them.
Right. So when you look at what I said that I think WS said, which is that it doesn't matter when the conduct occurred, it applies to all of them. If you look at the statutes and the purpose of the amendments to the statute more broadly.
But is the language changing all of those, in removing some of those impediments? Is the language the same? Are all of these amendments, we've been talking about the broad scope, but there's a lot that happened in these amendments. And I don't think we can just look at paint all of the individual sections that were changed with a broad brush. So I think it's difficult to argue and say that, well, yes, everything is the same. These impediments were removed, so we treat every single one the same when there was different language used at various points in the statutes and then in the legislative history, certainly different
well,
language.
Well, if even if you get there, when we look to the, again, I don't want to keep repeating myself, and I understand the question, but when you look at the overriding purpose of the statute, which is to open up the courthouse, I do think you look at them together. I don't think we have to parse
them. It did open up the courthouse. It did open up the courthouse after December 1st, 2019,
right,
for bringing claims against a passive abuser that is no longer, that is not within the household. Correct.
Again, and I understand Justice Wainwright's position, or at least in terms of the question she asked me, but I disagree. There's other cases we cited in our brief, James
Which
versus New Jersey,
disagreed
whether or not it's the conduct when the conduct occurs or not. We've cited other the statement I made. And
my
your,
question,
your
sorry, was just
your
is it procedural
substantive,
or substantive?
I understand that, and I'm saying that for the purpose of this, there should be no difference.
Okay.
Depending on how you define prospective, as I read it, and we cited there's other cases. You know, we cited James versus New Jersey Manufacturers. There's a state versus, I'm going to mispronounce the last name. It's cited in our brief, State versus Scutari, which talks about prospective application, meaning when the complaint was filed, when it was filed, irrespective of when the conduct occurred. So there is support for
James
the position
tells
that
us
I'm taking.
James tells us to determine whether the legislature has provided language as to whether something, because the presumption is prospective only, when the legislature has the authority to make things retroactive. So look for the language, says James, to see whether it's retroactive.
And you say that the substantive or procedural distinction shouldn't matter. So where does this court's opinion in Maya fit into that?
I'm sorry. Well,
where does this court's opinion in Maya fit into what you just said about, well,
yeah,
procedural and substantive doesn't matter for purposes of a retroactivity analysis?
I understand. I'm trying to reconcile that opinion with what I understood the opinion to be in WS, which I participated in. But, you know, Maya involves a very limited situation. It involves, I think, a one-year change in the law in terms of lost wages. I mean, this is much different. There's no legislative history in Maya that I'm aware of. It deals with a very limited expansion of damages to the plaintiffs in Maya. It's much, much different than
but
what
your,
this case
your colleague has told us that this is a very narrow situation. This is almost a criminal liability standard. This is not going to affect many cases. So you're, I think, making a very different argument. I know you're amicus in a party and you can disagree, but I think we're hearing two different things about this.
I don't think,
and I frankly don't think either one of them are all that important, because the legislature could make a big change, a small change, a medium change. They could revamp the statute or change a word. Our job is simply to figure out what it was doing in this instance.
Yeah, I don't, unless I misheard it, I don't think that's the argument that Mr. Russo was making. I think when he referenced the criminal standard, I think he was saying that the, even with the removal of the, within the household, we still have an elevated standard. I think what he was trying to say is it's still not a general negligence standard.
No,
it's still a very elevated standard.
Doesn't matter what it was.
And I'm not
just, I mean.
Let's just questions. Justice Hoffman asked a question about the legislature. There's been many cases before the Supreme Court. The one that comes to mind is, I think Justice LaVecchia wrote, it had to do with medical bills and the PIP statute. And there's been several opinions that come out of the court that if the legislature disagrees with, they act. The reported appellate division decision in this case came out over a year ago. And it's we're looking to have that upheld. If the legislature disagreed with that reported decision, which has been on the books now for a year or more, they could have acted. Just like they did in the Fernandez case,
Legislature tends to act upon our decisions.
I'm sorry.
The legislature is unlikely to come into the line between an appellate division decision and a Supreme Court decision.
Maybe, but they've definitely chimed in. And maybe it's just Supreme Court decisions, but they definitely have chimed in when they felt like their intent was misinterpreted and misunderstood by the court. Whether it's just the Supreme Court, I haven't done a thorough analysis. It came up, I thought of it during the argument.
It's a tough argument to make.
They do. But they have an opportunity, is my argument.
We should affirm because the legislature would have already stepped in?
Well, no.
No review had been sought from this court, and we granted.
No, I understand that, but we're trying to interpret what they were saying. If they thought they were misinterpreted by a court, appellate division, Supreme Court, they could have acted.
You're correct. If this court issues an opinion that they have a different take on, they will pass a new law.
Saying that in the very limited context of the last question Justice Hoffman asked, to the extent maybe there's no answer. There is an answer, whether it's realistic, whether it's likely, but it has happened, and I was only raising it in that context.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Huber.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. I'm the treasurer of the New Jersey State Bar Association. And I want to thank you, as we often do, for the opportunity to weigh in at this level on important issues. And the State Bar really looks at this as an important issue. Based upon the perception of unequal application of justice, leaving out a class of victims that seem to be similarly situated. And it is that result, in part, that brings us here today. And while I am an officer in the State Bar Association and representing them in that capacity, I do practice in this area, and some of the examples that I'd like you to consider, I think, point out the absurd results that can result or that can occur, based upon the proposed language, and I do. Read the room in a certain way that getting action is a very tough road to hoe at this point. But I would like you to consider what we see out there in the practice of this type of law and plaintiff's work. For example, we have a number of cases where we represent family members from the same family. I recently had five siblings, and there are a couple of cousins with one actor. But in a circumstance where you would have twins in a family where they were, attending the same middle school, and these twins had the same teacher, and the teacher sexually assaults the twins, and one sexual assault occurs in November of 2019 and the other in December. You have in this particular example, same family, same school board, same age, same rapist teacher, but you have a substantially different result and a different remedy.
Mr. Huber, doesn't the legislature have the ability to make distinctions that may cause some unfairness, but they they have the authority to draw lines. Juveniles are 18 years old. There's so many examples of situations where the legislatures put age and timing and created causes of actions that only start to apply or get rid of causes of actions. Is it really this court's job to say, let's look at what they did, and if we see that some people are going to be treated differently or a pair of twins are going to be treated differently potentially, we get to fix that?
Well, I understand what the court is saying, and I'm here to argue that you can. Whether you will or not, I understand the obstacles, and that the legislature a half mile down the street may be the preferred or first refuge for this issue for these victims who are seemingly disenfranchised from this statute, which is meant to bring about, you know, sea changing relief.
Lay out a pathway for the court to do what you're suggesting with reference to the statutes and to the legislative history.
Well, you know, I was looking at the fiscal report that was attached, and I know that one of the questions of the court, and it may have been Justice Patterson, as to when was the last word spoken, you know, by way of legislative history. And I think the response was the committee statement of March 7th of 2019, or March 9th, and I'm sorry if I missed that date. But the fiscal analysis was March 29th of the same year. And
just to be clear, I was just asking about the specific issue. Okay. And that's all I was asking, because I know a number of things did happen later.
Okay. And one is, you know, the fiscal analysis. And the fiscal analysis is a fairly thorough examination of the budget and the perceived need and the recommendation through OLS to increase the budget. And they base it upon a study, and they pull statistics, and they found that 465 teachers in this period of review, it was a five-year review, were disqualified from teaching. And you know, these were public school teachers. And in addition to that, all of those victims, and I think it was split between teachers qualified for child abuse as well as sexual assault. But nevertheless, you know, those teachers and their victims, just by nature of when the study occurred, were all prior to December 1st, 2019. And the statement that hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, per individual victim should be set aside by the legislature for these, or by school boards, for these particular tortious and intentional acts is important, because they're talking about public school teachers, it seems, from their survey and from the statistics that they compiled. And
this creating these or resuscitating these common law claims that could not be brought before?
Well, it does, I think, refer to a number of other claims, and it could be that it includes that. I understand that, Justice Apter, and I think that I'll concede that it's more than just the particular in the household claims.
In the household is not mentioned. Am I right?
I don't, with all due respect, I don't know that any particular claim is mentioned.
Right. But I mean, in terms of.
It is not.
It's not.
It is not. And I don't think any is.
And the legislature had just removed immunities, which pretty much had precluded all common law claims against public school vicarious liability claims. It had just removed immunities, as well as resuscitating statute of limitations on thousands of claims.
I'll add to that, opened up the door to outside the household claims prospectively.
Right, and I was clear to pay attention that you identified, you know, three other areas that could have been involved, three other types of claims that could have been involved.
Your point is a simple one, as I understand it, that this language includes additional costs related to the WTHMM.
Yes, for those
that's a fair
public school teachers
to present. Can I ask you to touch on the other piece of legislative history that we've spent a good deal of time on, and tell us what you think the Senate Judiciary Statement meant by saying this is intended to only apply prospectively?
I acknowledge that that's exactly what it says, and it's when I'd written out all my comments, I that is an elephant in the room that's not going to be ignored. And I thought that I should mention that the unicorn in the room should not be ignored either, which is this unprecedented, extraordinary, larger piece of legislation that we're encouraged to look at harmoniously. And although the court is pushing me toward the legislature is the better avenue for reform, for change here. I'm trying to get back on my thought. I'm sorry, right. Chief Justice.
Right.
I was going into the extraordinary relief that the statute provides, and we are reminded. And there's a quote that I put aside that said that it is appropriate to seek to harmonize legislative schemes in light of their purposes. And that's not just one purpose, but it's looking at all of their purposes. And, I guess it's a little flip to say, well, we're here right now before you addressing this issue, and you can make this change based upon the very disparate and absurd outcomes that I think you recognize, can and do in fact occur out there in the practice under this type of legal work. But other than saying that, looking at the legislation as a whole and what it clearly stands for, and that it is so extraordinary in moving the statute of limitations the way that it did, supports again under the harmonizing theory to get involved. I look at Maya as well, and I know that council said it's basically a smaller amount of people, because I think that the amount of time that was affected under the Wage and Hour Act was about a year, and it's important to be mindful that this. The effect of this change is not just going to be a year, it's going to affect so many people into the future, a year down the road, 5 years down the road, 35 years down the road.
Could we decide 2 years was too little and just say, something, let's make it 10 years? Would that be within consistent with separation of powers?
I don't think that the court would do that, but
I mean, could we do that?
I
because we thought it was unfair. Because why not, if it's two, why not make it 8 or 10 or forever?
Well, I don't think that you would do that. I don't think that you can, but you could. I mean, I guess you could if you wanted to, but generally I haven't seen the court step in that direction to such a large, giant step. I don't think that this step is as giant, and it's at your feet right now, and I believe that we're not asking for relief that would be as substantial as the court suggested, increasing the 2-year period to 10 years.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I again thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Hoover. Ms. Melcher, brief rebuttal. Thank you. Thank you all for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and is in recess for the day.